Tell me about anyone who has passed this way in the last few days, who might have had her with them. The man's face contorted with effort, but his mouth betrayed him.
Thalassa came through 2 days ago. She was leading a mule. The box on it smelled as if it held a prisoner, or a body.
Who is Thalassa? Kettle asked.
She is a Noiguan, second order.
The man struggled to raise his hands to cover his mouth, but the ropes held him. Describe the entrances to the Tetragode and their defenses, Kettle said.
The main entrance is a cave at the foot of cliffs in the Grampian Mountains, half a mile west of the...
With a scream, the man bit down hard and blood sprayed from his mouth. He gargled through it, as if he were still answering the question, but Nona couldn't make out the words. Kettle glanced down. Between the man's gore-spattered legs lay a chunk of flesh, a large piece of tongue. Nona felt Kettle clench her jaw. A moment later, her knife jutted from the man's left eye, his pain over.
You gave him Mistress Shade's truth pill, along with the antidote?
Zol asked, her voice as flat and free of emotion as ever.
I did.
How many more do you have?
None.
Kettle pulled her knife free and wiped the blade on the man's sleeve. It's not just a matter of rare ingredients. A powerful enchantment has to be used to bind them. Apple swapped favors with an academic named Hannah Stoy, but no help from the Academy is ever cheap.
No point trying to capture another one, then.
Zol knelt and started searching through the man's pockets.
They must have a camp near here. What is your plan?
I don't have one.
Kettle started back towards the trail. She paused.
How did you follow me without my noticing?
Carefully.
Zol looked up, pocketing a few coins.
Do not feel too bad about it. I am the chosen one, after all.
Although there was no hint of a smile, Nona suspected that she might have witnessed Zol's first joke.
We should take their robes. Kettle led the way back to the track. If we can find any that aren't obviously bloody. And cut our hair like they do. You're almost there as it is.
She glanced back at Zol's black and bristling thicket.
You should, Zol replied. You are shadowed like they are. I should be your prisoner.
They won't buy it.
Kettle reached the first of the fallen lightless. The woods were thick with the smell of death, clinging despite the wind.
The guards will know this lot by sight. Can't believe there are so many out here that they wouldn't. And if there were that many, then there would be passwords and such. Besides, we'll probably be spotted hunting for the entrance. I doubt it's obvious.
If we can get near, I can make them believe we belong there.
Zol flexed her fingers.
Really?
Even detached from Kettle's thoughts, Nona could feel the Grey Sister's doubt.
This isn't like Pan's classroom, you know. These lightless are...
Go home.
Zol's narrow gaze rocked Kettle on her heels. Kettle paused, as if struggling with some reply, then, without a word, she turned and strode back to the track. Once clear of the trees, she turned to the left and walked back the way she had travelled. Overhead the red stars bore witness, and in the east the white eye of the hope began to rise. It took perhaps 50 yards before Kettle's confident stride faltered. She glanced back and saw Zol following, and came to a halt.
What?
I changed your mind, Zol said.
Kettle turned to face her.
It was not easy, but a large part of you wants to go back to the convent anyhow, and I just helped it.
Threadwork? Kettle asked.
Yes.
Don't do that again, Kettle shivered. At least not on me. What makes you think it will be easier on a lightless?
Because they are not you, sister, Zol said. You have a strong mind, and it is well trained. But if you really did not want to do something, I could not make you do it. But making a guard believe that you are a lightless who is new to the order, or that the person next to them recognizes you, should be easier.
Should be?
Some people hold their threads more tightly than others. Zoe shrugged. I can also do this.
She thrust an open hand at Kettle, who burst into laughter. Even at the back of Kettle's mind, shielded from her emotions, Nona felt the echoes of it, and in the darkness of her cell, she smiled.
Marjal empathy, Zoe said, over Kettle's snorts and giggles. Shazal had academy tutors train me before I came to Sweet Mercy.
I... Kettle fought for breath, bent double.
You'll never need a punchline.
More laughter, before she forced herself to stand, still grinning. It works on you because you trust me, Zoe said, no hint of a smile on her. But with less guarded minds, I can have quite an effect.
I don't trust anyone. Kettle dropped her smile. Not out here. Not on a mission.
Trust is the most insidious of poisons, Zoe quoted Sister Apple. But you do trust me, and you are not on a mission. Nobody told you to do this.
Kettle frowned and glanced to the west, through the treetops. The moon's focus would be sweeping across the Marn by now, making the sea steam. Time was slipping away. So that's the plan. Present myself at the gate as a lightless with a prisoner, and hope that because I walk in shadow it won't take too much of a push for you to make them believe it.
Yes.
And then what?
Then we see.
They're dangerous, these Noiguin, Kettle said. They're like us. Like Grey Sisters, but worse, because killing is all they do. If just one of them spots us, we're done for.
The Noiguin are even spoken of on the ice. Zoe rolled her head, clicking the bones in her neck. They come after people in the night and murder them in their sleep. We are going into their home, where they believe that they are safe. If they find us, we will see what they are made of, and show them what we are made of.
Kettle grinned. And what's that?
Zoe did not smile in return. Sweet Mercy.
Chapter 29 Abbess Glass. The carriage that Brother Pelter had waiting for Abbess Glass proved to be quite luxurious. She had expected one of the usual black wagons, with barred windows normally used to transport suspects. But this one looked rather like the sort some lesser lord might own to bear him to the palace. Although if the doors had ever sported a coat of arms, the evidence had been expertly removed.
For me, Abbess Glass pursed her lips. I'm impressed.
Brother Pelter climbed in, and one of the Inquisition guards helped Glass into the opposite seat before joining her, another climbing up top. The other guards remained at the pillars as the carriage rattled away across the rock.
Two guards is all I warrant, brother.
The abbess inspected the silver chain wrapped half a dozen times around her wrists. I'm not sure whether to be offended that you think me so lacking in threat, or complimented that you have such trust in my good behavior. Brother Pelter made no reply, only watched her, cold-eyed. He had sent a rider on ahead, clutching a message scroll, presumably to forewarn of their arrival. I suppose it might be of considerable help to some parties if I did escape. Glass sat back. Nothing makes the Inquisition's job quite as easy as when someone declares their own guilt by running.
Like the novice in the caves, Brother Pelter replied. Nona Grey.
Glass shrugged. Nobody was arguing over her guilt, brother. Just her punishment.
Even the expensive suspension of the Inquisitor's garage proved unable to provide much comfort over bare rock, and they bounced and jolted along. Beside Glass, the overlapping plates of the Inquisition guard's armor rattled to the point of irritation. It proved something of a relief to begin the descent of the Vinery Stair, where a layer of earth softened the road. Glass leaned over, and with bound hands adjusted the slats of the window shutters, so that she could gaze out across the vineyards. Beyond them, farmland stretched until distance, and rolling hills devoured the detail, merging the patchwork fields into a blur. The sky above lay pale and strewn with streamers of cloud running west to east. Sweet Mercy was said to have been built upon the Rock of Faith to raise the sisters above mortal concerns and let them focus their adoration upon the ancestor. Now the everyday world had reached up its hand and plucked Glass from her eyrie. She settled back and sighed. She would have to see how well she remembered the ways of the worldly, and whether she still had that old fire in her. She would most certainly need it. Once on level ground, the carriage began to bump along the Verity Road, past the hedgerows and farmhouses that Glass had so often looked down upon from Sweet Mercy's heights. A mile rumbled beneath the wheels, another followed, and Glass retreated into the ordered chaos of her mind. She had from an early age practiced the memory arts often employed by holy sisters. The nuns used them when engaged within the scriptorium or required to recite lengthy portions of the family tree at ceremonies sponsored by some or other sis family. Some archives of useful information she recalled using nonsense songs, often lewd, or rambling stories associating one fact with the next in unexpected ways that anchored them into her memory. For the disposition of the clergy and of the Inquisition, however, she kept a map, hung upon the back of her mind and ever-glowing. Each report that arrived at her desk brought certain players into sharp resolution, their location at a particular time and place assured, their current whereabouts diffusing along likely routes and towards likely destinations as time blurred fact into speculation. The abbess received far fewer updates than she once had when the highest seat in the Tower of Inquiry was hers. But information flowed into Sweet Mercy at a rate that would have surprised many a lord spymaster. It came on feathered wings, on holy writ, on grey feet, and on red. It came through shadow bonds and thread links, through couriered parchment in cipher, or merely whispered watchwords. And it came through open ears in verity, many patient and attentive ears, some devout, some mercenary, and all passing word to the rock. Always it arrived unseen, often borne by the return of carts that carried the barrels and bottles of Sweet Mercy Red to the great and the good up and down the length of the empire. The carriage rumbled to a halt, jolting Glass from her inspection of imaginary maps. She frowned, wondering if the road ahead were blocked. The driver rapped four times on the roof, and the guard beside the abbess leaned forward to open the door.
"Abbess Glass, how wonderful to see you!"
Lord Thurin Taxis clambered in as Brother Pelter vacated the opposite seat to squeeze beside Glass. Thurin shared little in appearance with his sons, being neither golden and handsome as Raymel had been, nor dark and lean as Lano was. A portly man of no great height, he would barely reach his elder son's ribs. A florid face that seemed unlikely ever to have been handsome gave over to a thick, grey beard. He was smiling as he took his seat. A second man climbed in behind Thurin, a man in his 40s with a thick head of dark blonde hair and a luxurious blue robe. Taking his place beside Thurin, he fixed the abbess with glacial eyes.
"Joan Namsus," Glass made a politer nod than decorum demanded. "You're a long way from home."
Joelle's father kept estates close to the coast and was rarely seen in Verity's social circles save at the grandest of Taxus flings.
On my way to another engagement, I received word that my daughter had been severely injured whilst in your care, Abbess. High Priest Nevis suggested that I visit Joelle before deciding whether to remove her from the convent.
Glass nodded. A broken knee, a nasty injury, and not one sustained during training. She offered her most sincere smile. The girl's classmistress, Sister Spire, reported several of Joelle's friends injured on the same day, and Nona covered in bruises. The truth of the matter was pretty clear, and Nona must have been heavily outnumbered for Joelle not to report the incident, painting herself as victim.
Imagine, all that time practicing, punching and kicking and stabbing and slashing, and then poor Joelle hurts herself falling down the dormitory stairs.
The carriage lurched back into motion, and Glass peered through the slats.
Though if you're wanting to visit your daughter at the convent, you'll find we're going the wrong way.
We're only riding a short distance with you, Abbess.
Theron Taxus spoke up now, still full of apparent good humor. Glass didn't allow the mask to fool her. She knew the Taxus Lord as a cunning operator. He wielded considerable power at court on account of the family's wealth. But he had also inherited and possibly improved upon many of the skills his distant ancestors had relied on to make that fortune in the first place.
Joanne must get to the convent and see his daughter. I've asked him to draw up plans for the running of the place in the Emperor's name, in anticipation of Crucible taking Sweet Mercy from the church, as he surely will once your guilt has been established.
It never hurts to be prepared. Glass nodded. She wouldn't give the man the satisfaction he was so obviously trying to squeeze from her distress. And will you be visiting the convent, Lord Taxus?
I have other business to attend to.
His smile broadened.
You should have let that child hang, Abbess. It would have been a quick and easy death. Less than she deserved after leaving Raymel for dead.
On that we disagree. Glass kept her tone light.
I hope your chains are more comfortable than the last time you faced trial, Abbess. I heard that they put you in an iron yoke and burned the flesh from your palm.
It was me that demanded the candle and held my hand to it. Glass met Thurin's eyes.
And again you kept the girl from an easy death. Drowning is not so bad, I'm told. Takes no longer than a bad hanging and hurts less. The assassin's knife would have been quick, too.
I didn't believe she deserved death, easy or hard.
No, you had her trained to kill instead.
A flicker of anger now.
And she killed my son.
Glass kept her mouth shut, her gaze darting to the Inquisitor, and finding him peering through the window slats, studiously ignoring the conversation.
And in the end, oh, delicious irony.
Theron forced the humor back onto his face.
It is your own order that she breaks, and which sees her driven from your protection.
He raised a hand to stroke his chin.
Imagine if she were captured out there somewhere in the corridor. Do you think she would meet an easy death then, dear Abbess?
I would think anyone who tried to capture that girl would be taking their life in their hands.
Glass fixed Thurin with a hard stare, backed by a confidence she didn't feel.
Imagine if she were captured, Thurin repeated, his voice soft now. Do you think they would invite me to watch her die?
The Emperor forbid you.
The Emperor will never know.
He lurched forward, roaring his words, flecks of spittle peppering Glass's cheeks.
Do you think you're going to tell him? Do you think it's Crucicle's palace the Inquisitor here is taking you to?
Thurin's face was now red and twisted.
the rage he had been holding back all this time let free in a sudden rush.
Did you think you'd won again with your forgotten laws and petty little rules? Did you, Abbas? Did you?
I cannot be tried at the tower.
You'll be tried in a palace, you sorry hag. You'll be tried in a palace, found guilty in a palace, and burned in a palace. Just not crucicles. Pelter here is taking you to Shazal. How do you like that? And while you're getting your just deserts, I will be making sure that a certain young novice of your acquaintance is wishing with all her black heart that you'd let her hang, or drown, or even that Raymel had taken his pleasure, because she won't die easy, Abbas. She really won't.
Glass bent her head to hide the emotion she couldn't keep from her face. She stared at her hands, and at the silver chain wrapped around her wrists. But what she saw in her mind were dominoes falling. Endless lines of dominoes, one toppling the next, lines splitting, splitting again, everything in motion, the complexity doubling and redoubling, the clatter swelling into a roar, the speed increasing, everything out of control. It seemed so long ago when Judge Ervone had pronounced,
"This is a poor decision, Abbas."
And she had replied, "Even so," and had with two words toppled the first domino. Chapter 30. Nona slipped from Kettle's mind into her own dreams, and from those into a fitful state halfway between sleep and waking. Gradually her eyes found focus on a single point of brightness, and her body made sense of itself. She realized that the cold beneath her cheek was that of a flagstone, and raised her head. She uncoiled slowly, groaning to herself. A single small candle had been placed on the ground just beyond the sweep of the door. Already it had burned down to less than a thumb's length. Its only purpose appeared to be to illuminate the knife set before it on the floor. Nona squinted, then sat back against the wall. A single object had answered most of her questions. A throwing knife of modest size, its pommel a plain iron ball. The grip bound from pommel to hilt with a thin strip of leather. The Noiguan had left the weapon. The same Noiguan who had failed to take Nona's life on her second night at Sweet Mercy. The Noiguan who had stabbed Kettle in the wilds while hunting Nona 2 years later and been hurt in turn. The Noiguan who had tried to re-enter Sweet Mercy by the caves. The Noiguan the Holothur had driven away.
Was it a woman who captured me in the graveyard?
Yes.
The same one who came to Raymel's side after I sliced his neck? The same one who was sent to kill me?
Yes.
You didn't think to mention it?
How would it help?
Talassa. That was what the Lightless had named her with the bitter taste of the poisoner's truth upon the tongue he had bitten off moments later. She might well have been waiting close to the rock, waiting for any whisper of her prey. How far had she followed Nona before making her move? Maybe for days. Nona had been headed in the right direction after all, and what better way to get your target to your lair than have it walk itself there? It must have been when Nona started talking to people in White Lake that Talassa had decided to strike, worried that the novice would find companions or guides there and gain safety in numbers. Kiot circled Nona's neck, trying to find a weakness in the collar that would let him slide beneath. She ignored his efforts, and found her gaze returning to the knife. It had been left there as a message, to put fear into her. And it was working.
How are you going to get out of here?
Nona had been staring at the candle, and now as it guttered into darkness, wax consumed, Kiot broke into the emptiness of her mind.
I don't know.
Prison cells and chains were much the same all the length of Abath's corridor, simple and effective. Nona had no sudden inspiration as to how to defeat them. With the band off one wrist, or the collar removed from her neck, she would make short work of the rest of her restraints. But the things were made not to be removed without a key.
Why do you think they haven't killed you yet?
Whatever the reason, it can't be good. Nona slammed her wristband against the wall. Despite her effort to hold her hand back, it hit the stones too, skinning her knuckles. In the darkness, she could barely see her arm, let alone any detail. But the wristband revealed no damage beneath questing fingertips. She checked the chain, first where it attached to the wall, then each link until she reached her ankle cuff. She tried twisting, pulling, swinging the chain against the ground, all with no result. She attempted to thread the chain beneath the wristbands, but the links proved too thick and the fit too snug.
Animals in traps often gnaw their foot off to escape.
I don't think I would get far hopping. The poisoner had taught them that all bonds could be slipped, but Nona suspected she had meant those on wrists rather than ankles, and with the bands fitting so tightly, it seemed unlikely they would come off over her hands without taking most of her skin and breaking bones. Perhaps not even then. Nona stared at the slightly darker patch by the door. All that she could see of the knife, now that the candle had burned out. It would be a useful thing to have, but at the full extension of the chain and lying flat, she was still yards short of reaching it. Talassa left it there and me here, so I would try to reach it, so I would know who had me, and so that the fear would grow inside me. Nona pulled off the smock they'd put her in. Immediately she felt the cold, as if invisible hands were touching her in the dark, pinching away her body warmth. She felt more vulnerable too, which she reminded herself was ridiculous, given that she was chained in the dungeons of the Noi Guin. She could hardly be more vulnerable, and a linen smock would not preserve her. Nona knew without trying that the garment wasn't long enough to reach the knife, but artfully torn it might be. She would normally slice the thing apart with an invisible fingernail. Robbed of her abilities, she resorted to brute strength. At first, the material resisted her, but once she found a seam, it ripped quickly. Within a minute or two, she had made the thing twice as long as she was tall and had torn additional holes in it, hoping one would encircle some part of the weapon. The flagstones were gritty, grime-covered and cold. Lying naked, flat out, Nona began to flail with her torn smock. Experience trying to grapple hidden and possibly non-existent edges in the dark of the undercaves had schooled Nona to persistence. A score of tries brought no success. Twice Nona thought she had snagged the dagger, only to gently increase the pull and find her smock returning to her without the scrape of metal on stone.
Again!
Kiot urged. Nona threw the material out, drew it back, threw it out. Drew it back. She threw again. It snagged. She pulled. The knife's weight resisted her. It seemed well entangled. She pulled harder. Somewhere outside, close at hand, something fell with a clatter. A small bell, perhaps? The door began to open almost immediately. Nona pulled harder. The knife resisted. She pulled harder still, and the smock came free with a tearing sound. A figure stood in the doorway, one of the lightless, framed by illumination that had seemed barely enough to see by when Nona had been escorted down the corridor, and now made her screw up her eyes. The man bent down and picked up the cord that tied the knife in the cell to the bell that had rested just outside the door. He looked at her, lying there before him, his face too shadowed for any expression to be read, then backed out. Closing the door behind him. A key turned in the lock.
Again? He was sitting just outside all this time. Waiting.
Kiot sounded grudgingly appreciative. Nona opened her mouth to curse her jailer, or Kiot, or both, and finding she had no word sufficiently vile, closed it again. She levered herself to her knees and retreated to the wall, wrapping herself in failure, misery, and the tatters of her smock. Accord. Nona wondered how she had missed seeing it. Even disguised and in a darkened room, the cord shouldn't have escaped her. She had been trained to see. She sat up straighter, shrugging off self-pity, and applied her training, focusing on the memory of a flame, the start of the route into her clarity trance. Not every discipline she had learned could be forbidden by sigil-marked iron. Clarity settled upon Nona, frosting across her skin, cleansing the darkness of ambiguity, and bringing every faint sound into focus as if the instrument of her being had been tuned to perfection. Nona isolated one sense, then the next, as Sister Pan had taught her, then brought all five together. She could hear the man outside the door draw breath, exhale, draw breath. The dark still hid what it hid, but those shapes it did offer were extracted and given meaning. Nona ran her fingertips across her restraints, learning all their secrets, from the sigils cut into the curved iron to the details of hinge and clasp. Nothing. The iron peg that anchored the end of the chain attached to her ankle cuff had been driven between two great stones in the wall, held there more by the weight pressing on the stone above it than by the mortar filling the joint. Nona moved the chain to one side and pulled, bracing her legs against the floor and tugging slightly upward.
Every prisoner tests their chains. If they came loose, then the jailers would replace them with stronger ones. An untold number of desperate men and women have tested these cells before you and helped refine them.
Why don't you help me then? Nona replied. When I die, you're going back to lurking on the boundary where Raymel found you.
There's nothing I can do. I can't make you stronger.
Nona put her head back against the cold stone wall. They had taken her blades, taken all of the martial skills she had been working on in private. Her flame work was still remedial, her rock work hardly enough to fracture a pebble. But both might have been useful. They had shut her off from the path and threads. All they'd left her was her speed. With a lever, I could turn this pin, work it free. Nona imagined a steel rod narrow enough to slide through the eye of the pin alongside the last link of chain. With a long enough lever and a fulcrum, a person could move the world.
You don't have a lever.
It doesn't have to be a lever. Anything that could wrap it, grip it, allow her to apply her strength further out to twist it. If she held the pin in her fist and tried to rotate it, she could break her bones and not move it a degree. If the pin were fixed at the center of a cartwheel, she could grip the outer rim and twist it with little effort, no matter how tightly it was anchored.
You don't have anything else.
Kiot sounded as if he were already thinking of his return to the chaos he came from, and of his next escape. Nona doubted opportunities came along often. Perhaps there wouldn't be another chance for Kiot before the ice closed and the moon fell. Nona began to wind the chain around the wall pin. After one turn, the second layer of chain started to slip off the first. There wasn't enough pin exposed to wrap one turn next to the other, and no point to that anyway. She needed to build out. Slowly, and with enormous care, she managed to wrap three turns around the pin, each layer of chain resting on the one below, but inevitably the whole lot began to slide, then collapsed, and fell off the pin. She knelt, the gritty stone hurting her knees, racking her brain for other ideas. How many prisoners had done the same before? How long had it taken before they resigned themselves to failure and sat helpless, shivering in the dark, waiting on the mercy of the Noi Guin? I was in that convent 5 years. It must have taught me something useful.
They taught you to reach the path. That's the only true power.
Nona frowned. Actually, they didn't. They told me to go slow, serene, approach it gently. I didn't have any success until I learned to use my anger, to run at it, use my speed. She wrapped the chain around the pin again, slow, thoughtful. It slipped off. I need to use my speed. Nona threw herself into the space between heartbeats. In the darkness of the cell, nothing changed, save that the chain went from flexible to stiff, resisting motion at the speed she demanded of it. She began to wrap it around the pin again, forming an ever-widening coil against the wall. Unable to slip, because she gave them no time in which to slip, the layers of chain spiraled out to 6 inches on each side before Nona ran out of chain. She threw herself at the circular coil with the wall pin at its midst, and gripped the outer edges, hauling to try to rotate the whole lot. With no time to slip, the links locked together, and for one small fraction of a second, the whole coil acted as if it were a solid, unbreakable body. A moment later, the mass of links fell away from the wall, a shapeless weight of chain hanging from her fingers.
Did it move?
A note of interest from Keok now. Nona didn't know, but she got ready to try again. Struggling with a hopeless task in a dark cell might offer little comfort, but it beat thinking about that knife and what was coming. Chapter 31 The Grampian Mountains rose in a ridge that crossed the corridor. North and south the range marched into the ice, buckling the sheet for scores of miles until at last the ice grew deep enough to drown even the peaks. Many referred to them as the Empire Wall, tacit acknowledgement that it was the terrain, more than the legions sent by successive emperors, that took most credit for holding back the Scythrol hordes for the last century.
Shazal's palace is not far from this place.
Zoe paused to scan the snow-capped ridge. She had abandoned her range coat in favor of the jacket worn by the Lightless, who had been pretending to be a hunter. They had managed to wash most of the blood spatters off, and to disguise the rest with mud.
I'm sure I know these mountains.
Kettle raised a brow. I've not visited the area. I crossed to Scythrol through Windsong Pass, 20 miles north of here. Her gaze roamed the landscape of fractured rock ahead of them. Lightless watchers could be stationed anywhere. A minute earlier, a mountain goat had broken from the shadow of a boulder on the slope just above them. The shock had set Kettle's heart pounding, and the moment of panic had allowed Nona's awareness to push along the bond they shared. Kettle could feel the girl, watching from her eyes. Why they couldn't speak to each other, she couldn't say. Perhaps the Tetragoad had barriers that limited their contact. Either way, she hoped Nona would draw comfort from their approach. She tried to bury the thought that even with all the Grey Sisters and all the Red, she would not be confident of breaching the Noiguan stronghold.
That peak, with the snow pluming off it.
Zol nodded towards it. She couldn't point. Her wrists were bound behind her, tethered to a rope Kettle held.
I am sure it can be seen from the palace.
How sure? Zol paused before answering.
It is hard to say. It might just be similar, or appear very different from a new angle. But Shazal's palace is on the western flanks of the Grampians, and you can see the southern ice from her towers. It cannot be too many miles from here.
Kettle bit her lip, continuing to hunt the slopes. Even if Shazal were only 5 or 10 miles away, it could take a day or two to cover the distance across the cliffs and ravines of the Grampians. It seemed unlikely that her troops would patrol the mountains in any number. The Scythrol threat was always met at the passes. The invasion game was just a question of whether the enemy would try to force passage through the lowest and easiest pass, contending with the strongest defenses, or pit themselves against the elements to risk a high pass and lighter defenses. Let me concentrate a moment. Kettle stopped walking. She had been pursuing the thread bond she had with Nona. Where a shadow bond would give a sense of direction as the crow might fly or the shadow points, the thread bond seemed to remember the path taken. But in the folds of the mountain's roots it had proved hard to follow, like sniffing out the vague trace of scent where someone had passed. Now, though, with Nona sitting in the back of her mind, Kettle found it easier to discern her path. It wasn't really a sniffing or a seeing, more of a knowing. Kettle felt her way through the options before her and let the right one draw her to it.
Down there.
Kettle spotted the first watch point a mile on, then a second, and a third. The Lightless observed her advance from rock shelters on the slopes above. Another mile of hard climbing brought Kettle and Zol to a series of steps so artfully made as to almost appear natural. They led up to the dark mouth of a cave at the base of a sullen cliff of grey stone. From a distance, the size of the cave mouth proved impossible to judge. The mountains offered nothing by which to gain a sense of scale, not even a stunted tree. As Kettle came closer, she realized that the opening was actually a modest one, through which a carriage would have to scrape its way. The ground at the base of the cliff proved fairly level, a shelf in the mountainside, carpeted with broken stone, frost shattered from the cliff above. They trudged up towards the entrance, Zol stumbling from time to time to make herself appear more prey than predator.
Stop!
Five figures broke from the cave mouth, grey-robed Lightless, four with crossbows. In the midst of her clarity trance, Kettle took them all in, down to the heavy bolts in the bows of the two to the left, and the fanned needle clusters in the bows of those on the right. A shot from either of those crossbows would launch a funnel of a dozen or more poisoned darts, making evasion or deflection near impossible.
Who are you?
Kettle had been wishing, ever since the Lightless who pretended to be a woodsman had bitten out his tongue, that she had asked the names of his companions. Her knowledge of the Noiguan was substantial compared to the rumor and myth that most people laid claim to. But it didn't extend to knowing if their servants adopted new names and adhered to any particular convention.
My,
she said. It's easier to lie when you're telling the truth.
I've brought this prisoner for Telassa to interrogate. She has information about the convent.
Kettle raised her head to dispel any suspicion that she was hiding beneath the hood of the robe she'd taken from the Lightless. She reached out to shove Zol's shoulder, sending her stumbling forward, getting the girl closer so that she might work the magic she had claimed would make this ruse succeed. Four crossbows lifted, four fingers tightened on triggers. Back in the cave that looked to broaden as it went on rather than to narrow, Kettle caught other motion.
Come here, you!
Kettle pulled on the rope, making a show of holding Zol back, whilst at the same time letting her close another yard on the five Lightless immediately before her.
One more step, and I'll have her shot. Then you.
The man in the center of the five watched Kettle with pale eyes set in a broad face. He overtopped 6 foot, his solid build apparent despite his robes. He bore no obvious weapon, but darkness smoked around his hands. Kettle could sense the shadows around him. This one had been pushed further into the night than his companions. Further than her, too.
My of the Lightless is taking me to Telassa.
Zol kept her face down, and her voice was quiet, but it seemed to burn through the air. Nona sensed it buzzing in Kettle's skull.
I am her prisoner.
Kettle felt the words building up, spiraling around her, demanding that she accept their truth. It was almost true, after all. It would be easier to believe it.
Telassa will want to see me.
Zol said, her voice resonant.
Talassa will want to see her.
The officer nodded. His pale eyes never left Kettle's face. The lack of malice in them worried her. Cruelty bred stupidity, but the quiet dedication of the Lightless promised only efficiency and success in attaining their goals.
Escort Mai and her prisoner to the holding cells.
The man indicated the cave, and at his signal four more Lightless came forward. The first of them had a slightly puzzled look.
I'm to take this woman to the cells, Arthran.
The man looked down at his subordinate, a frown creasing his forehead.
Yes, take Mai and her prisoner to the cells.
Kettle could see the tension in Zol's jaw as she stood, head down, some mutter on her lips. The woman nodded and indicated that Kettle should follow her. Two of her companions moved to flank Kettle and Zol, the third bringing up the rear.
Come.
The entrance to the Tetragode opened out beyond the cave mouth into a natural cavern of impressive dimensions. A score or so Lightless occupied the space, some busy with a stack of barrels and crates near the center, others armed and ready in natural galleries along the rear wall. Kettle tried not to look around too obviously, but set that desire against the need to understand the challenges attendant on leaving again. She wondered briefly how the supplies came to be there. If they were brought in by foot across the foothills, then the cost would be stupendous, and the trail left for any curious party to follow would be hard to miss. Kettle was glad of the escort inasmuch as it meant that the woman in front of her was leading the way. They had soon passed enough junctions for it to grow clear that becoming lost was a real possibility. She was less glad of the audience. It made little sense to her that the prisoner needed three extra guards here, when the ideal time to escape would have been out among the foothills with just one captor. The tunnels were natural, cut by ancient rivers, but shaped here and there by pick and hammer. The floor, where not level with the hard-packed sediment of those vanished rivers, had been evened out with rubble or well-secured planks. Wooden steps allowed easy passage up the steeper inclines. The spread-out and labyrinthine nature of the Tetragode was perhaps as important a defense as the strong points, but did mean that most of the complex lay empty at any given time. The long galleries returned to darkness once Kettle's party had passed through and silence stalked them. The nun felt a sense of familiarity, having explored the caverns beneath the Rock of Faith at length, and behind those thoughts Nona added her own appreciation of deep places. The first major checkpoint came as a small fortress built around the exit from a cavern that could have housed a large fortress. Lightless watched from the battlements, and raised a portcullis when hailed. In the long stone-clad tunnel that led through the fortress, a single Noiguan waited, seated at a desk set in their path. A score of murder holes pierced the ceiling, and the walls for 10 yards before and behind the desk. Where Kettle's attention focused discreetly upon the walls, Nona drank in the details of the Noiguan. Echoes of Kettle's memories informed Nona that the assassin who had tracked her on her ranging had been similar in appearance. Additionally, Sister Tallow's report to the convent table had described the two she fought outside the novice dormitories years before to be clad in the same manner. The Noiguan's most striking feature was the black skin mask that covered his face, with just a slit exposing the eyes and perforations at the nose and mouth. Taken from the hull of a tribe ship, the stuff was as flexible as silk unless some object tried to move it too swiftly, in which case it became rigid and tougher than steel. A close-fitting leather hood, descending to spread out over the shoulders, prevented Nona from telling how far the black skin extended. Red sisters who were Hunska Primes or Fullbloods, as most were, would wear black skin only over their torso, as otherwise it could resist their fastest movements, with unfortunate consequences. Also, the stuff, being fabulously rare, was often in too short supply to be used more widely. The rest of the Neuguin's outfit was black leather, variously ridged or reinforced with iron plates. The dark grey cloak was presumably a concession to the enduring chill of subterranean life, and shed when action was required.
"Where are you going?"
The Neuguin studied them, his eyes like black beads within the slits of his mask.
"Arthran received this woman at the West Cave. He instructed me to escort her and the prisoner to the holding cells."
The Lightless stepped aside, leaving Kettle and Zol fully exposed to the Neuguin's scrutiny.
"I'm Mai of the Lightless,"
Kettle interrupted the assassin. It was better to break decorum than let someone state their opinion out loud. Once anything was spoken, it became harder to change.
"You know me, surely?"
She stepped up beside her prisoner.
"You know her."
Zol's whisper buzzed through the air. She stood, head bowed, the tendons in her neck rigid with the effort of working her geas.
"I know her,"
a whispered reply from all four of the escort. Kettle heard it echoed behind the walls too, coming down through the murder holes above them.
"I know her."
"I don't know this woman."
The Neuguin stood, though slowly, puzzled.
"You know her."
Zol's whisper came more intense, bleeding through the air. Kettle had to restrain herself from shouting it out.
"I know her,"
one of the escort yelled it, proud of the fact.
"No."
The Neuguin raised an empty hand, as if fending off the suggestion. The fingers of his other hand quested for the hilt of the knife at his hip.
"I don't know you."
Zol changed tactics. She raised her head and her voice.
"Your watch is over. Go to your beds, now."
Kettle couldn't help but glance at her. The Ice Tribe's face had grown pale, her eyes black wells. Her whole body trembled with effort, and a trickle of blood ran from one nostril. The Neuguin stood, seeming to struggle with the concept. Behind Kettle, the four Lightless turned on their heels and began to walk away. From the sounds behind the walls, footsteps, doors opening, closing, others were also following the suggestion. Seconds passed, and still the Neuguin stood there while his servants walked away.
"Leave!"
Zol spoke the word through gritted teeth. The sound sunk into the stone, the command hanging between her and the assassin in the silence that followed. The Neuguin closed his fingers around the hilt of his blade. An instant later, without warning, as if something snapped, Zol slipped her bonds, snatched out the knife hidden beneath her jacket, and threw herself over the desk at the Neuguin. Even Kettle, who had seen Zol training on dozens of occasions, was taken by surprise, shocked by the girl's swiftness. Both feet struck the assassin's stomach, driving him back. By the time Kettle had drawn her sword, Zol had one hand around the Neuguin's wrist, controlling his knife, while driving her own up into his armpit. The Neuguin brought his arm tight to his body, to trap the blade bedded in his flesh, and drove his forehead forward towards Zol's face. She twisted her neck to avoid the headbutt, and hooking her leg behind his knee, drove the man backwards to the floor. Kettle lost sight of the conflict as she turned. Three of the four Lightless were still walking away. Their leader had halted in confusion. Kettle drew her knife in her offhand, and hoped that the Lightless hidden by the walls were already out of their compartments. With doors closed behind them, they would be shielded from being distracted by the sound of the fight. Moving fast, Kettle sliced the woman's throat from behind and strode past without a second glance. Back along the tunnel, an awful screaming started, so agonized that Kettle couldn't tell if it was Zol or her enemy. A moment later, the nun caught up with the rest of the escort. She sliced two more throats and buried her knife between the vertebrae of the third.
In the darkness behind Kettle's eyes, Nona winced at the brutality of it. Without her own heart pounding, and without the imminent threat to life and limb, she found such killing much harder to watch. Kettle spun around. The first of the lightless had her hands to her neck, blood welling between her fingers, but she had yet to fall. Kettle raced past her, towards the desk that stood amid the murder holes. Behind it, Zol and the Noiguan were still entangled, but the oak bureau blocked all save the flailing of legs. The scene that greeted Kettle as she ran around the desk was a grisly one. Zol had trapped the Noiguan's knife arm, scissoring it between her legs while she forced her thumbs into his eyes. His screaming ended suddenly. Behind Kettle, the first thump of a body hitting the ground echoed along the tunnel. Three more followed as Zol regained her feet. She wrenched her dagger clear and stood back from the spreading pool of blood in which the Noiguan lay. Kettle blinked.
You killed a Noiguan.
His mind was confused.
Zol reached up to squeeze her forehead, wincing, as if she had a headache beside which all other considerations, such as the gore her thumb was smearing across her temple, were secondary.
Do we have time to take his clothing?
Take the mask if it will come, but we have to move. The others will be coming.
They'll have felt him die.
How many?
Zol stooped to wrestle with the black skin mask. Kettle stared down the tunnel, all her senses open wide. Noiguan were shadow-bonded, not to a few closest to them, but each to the other in a great, dark web.
All of them.
Chapter 32 Abyss Glass. The Empire had always rested against the Sea of Marn. The roots of its origin lay tangled as much in myth as in history. But most scholars agreed that from tough and independent fisherfolk, a tightly knit confederation of ports and coastal towns had grown. The midst of this proto-state had spawned the founder of the Empire. That man, Gulamel Entsis, had forged eastward, over land, despite his naval power and the salt water in his veins. In fact, apart from short-lived strongholds established at vast cost on the Durnish shores and never held for more than a generation, the Empire's history had always been one of driving east along the corridor. At its height, the Empire stretched 700 miles east, through all of what later became Scythrol and deep into the Alden, the federation of city-states that was now the kingdom of Ald. The reversal had been swift. In the space of 40 years and 6 weak emperors, the border had fallen back against the rocky spine of the Grampians, and there it stayed, immovable. Some now declared empire too grand a name for the territory currently held, and emperor too lofty a title for the men and women who took its highest seat. To Abyss Glass's mind, both titles had been earned through centuries of greatness. Even so, she had to agree that when the corridor wind picked up its feet and raced eastward, then the Empire could be crossed at such a speed that it really did feel quite small. Brother Pelter exchanged the carriage horses at various stops and had them driven hard. Along the spine of the Empire lay metalled roads, built in the reign of Gulamel V for swift movement of troops in time of war. They had been well maintained ever since. Along such routes the carriage devoured the miles before it. Twice they took to the rivers, pressed upstream by the wind's hand, swapping to new carriages at the Patience Monastery and at the estate of the newest Archon, Hedda. Glass felt at each stage as though they were fleeing something rather than just hastening towards Shirzal's palace. Perhaps Pelter worried that Red Sisters were in hot pursuit, bent on freeing his prisoner. No such rescue would come, though. Glass had forbidden it. And, though she might never quite understand why, the loyalty that had grown around her came coupled with an obedience that was just as deep and enduring.
During the long days of travel, Glass made conversation, or at least one half of it, and slowly, the boredom, and the pressure of questions unanswered, eased Brother Pelter.